Be the right club. Be the right club today.
Yes! Johnny, that's better than most.
How about him?
That is better than most. Better than most!
Expect anything different?
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the No Laying Up Podcast. Busy podcast week. This is our third one of the week, but we are out, myself and Big Randy, out here in Chicago for the KPMG Women's PGA Championship. Randy, your first LPGA event of any kind, what are your first impressions? The tournament hasn't started yet. This is Wednesday that we're recording this, but what are your impressions?
Well, first of all, thank you guys for letting me out of the kill house. It's nice to see the sun every now and again. Yeah, great to be out here. This is one I've been looking forward to. As you said, I've never been to an LPGA event, so I was really excited to get out here and just, it's all a new experience for me. My first, I guess, initial impressions are impressive infrastructure. We are at a course, Kemper Lakes. They have a small clubhouse and they utilize it for players and kind of guests and meals, but it's really not the focal point of anything this week. Tons of man-made tents, portable structures. So real impressive operation going. Was fortunate enough, got to tag along in the Pro-Am yesterday and had a wonderful time. I think you'll hear from Karen Stupples later on. And obviously we got to play alongside Michelle Wee. Very, very easy to talk to, very outgoing. Was just a real kind of pleasurable 4.5-5 hours to spend with them. Down to earth, approachable. It was a lot of fun.
It's everything that, you know, we obviously, Tron and DJ and I went out to the Kia Classic in March, had a great experience with the LPGA. And Big Randy, unfortunately, didn't get to join for Germany, but to do a back-to-back stretch of Euro Tour and LPGA is just, just all the helpful people you meet and kind of the people that help tee you up to get these interviews happen and stuff. It's just wonderful structure, and it is a treat to be here. It's a really impressive operation, and it feels like a really big event, and the girls are super excited about it. So we're excited, and we got the chance to chat with Lydia Ko. We got 20 minutes with her. We have a bunch of other interviews we're doing this week. These are going to be the ones you hear this week. We spent about 20 minutes with her, and then we also spent about almost 40 with Karen Stupples, as Big Randy mentioned, who works for the Golf Channel, is a retired professional golfer. I didn't know a whole lot about her until as soon as she walked up yesterday, I recognized her voice from watching LPGA coverage and her work on in other men's golf as well and stuff for the BBC. So you'll recognize her voice when you hear it, and she has some stories. She was awesome. She was not a scheduled guest. We had such a great time with her yesterday. We're like, we are going to need you for the podcast immediately. So
yeah,
we're going to roll first into the Lydia interview, but first, Big Randy.
Yeah, no, I was just going to mention Golf Channel coverage all week.
That's
so
right.
So this will be coming out, I believe, on Wednesday. You should be hearing this, maybe Thursday morning. But for sure, if you check it out on Golf Channel, they will have live coverage Thursday through Sunday.
Yeah, they are blowing it out. They have a huge team here this week, and we're excited to see the coverage. And we didn't get to see much actual tournament golf when we went out to the Kia. So excited to actually walk around, follow some shots, follow some girls for a lengthy period of time, and really take the whole experience in. But it's been wonderful so far. It's been a busy week, but it's been a fun one. I'm looking forward to the championship getting started.
I was going to say, more to come with some videos, too. We've had fun off the course. So
we got the lab. The editing bay is very busy. But real quick, before we do turn it over to Lydia Ko, Lydia and I have something in common, as well as my new best friend, Michelle Wee. We all play the new graphene-infused ChromeSoft X ball from Callaway. We had interchangeable golf balls that we could play during the Pro-Am, so that was kind of cool. We did talk about which kind of ball she plays and what she looks for in a golf ball and how she tries to balance spin and distance and whatnot. And it's clear that the Callaway ChromeSoft ball has made an impact on her game, and Lydia does also play the same golf ball. So CallawayGolf.com for more information, CallawayGolf.com/ChromeSoft. The 2018 ball is the ball that changed the ball. It has a softer feel with less spin off the tee and more spin around the greens. I promise it's unlike anything you've experienced in a golf ball on tour, and it's proven on all tours. Sergio's won with it this year. Phil has obviously won with it this year. Aaron Wise has won with it. We keep going. But you kind of get the picture. So without further ado, let's turn it over to Lydia Ko first, and then we will be joined by Karen Supples. All right, welcoming in here at the KPMG Women's PGA, Lydia Ko. Lydia, you are a two-time major winner. I imagine you have a bit of a routine when it comes to showing up at a major now, but what is preparation like for a major? Is it any different than any other tournament?
I don't think I take it any differently. You know, in the first few years, I felt like, man, you know, coming into a major week, this is a major. Oh my God, I have to play well, it's a major. But I'm trying to think of it less that way and just don't take it any differently to any other event. And I think that just makes it, you know, a little easier on me, a little less stressful. So, yeah, I'm trying to, you know, get used to the golf course, get used to the conditions, and obviously, especially at a tournament like this where the course changes every year, you really want to get a good hang of it before Thursday comes.
Sure. You've accomplished, obviously, so much at such a young age. Did you ever have any idea as to what you were doing from a historical standpoint, or do you have that perspective now at any point?
Not at all.
No?
I don't even know if it's sunk in yet. You know, I think it's always been a dream of mine to play on the LPGA, you know, to hopefully, you know, be the number one ranked player. But I think all of those things kind of hit me a lot quicker than you could ever dream of. And obviously, I'm very fortunate in that aspect. But, you know, this is such a cool position to be in. And, you know, just being on tour, I mean, this is my fifth year on tour already. I feel like I'm 30, but I'm still 21. It's just legal. But, you know, the girls are great. And I think that's why we have such a great time on tour.
You've accomplished so much, obviously, already. Talk to us about how does the goal-setting process change?
To me, week to week, I, you know, try and set goals, you know, going into that week, you know, what position I want to finish, or, you know, if I've been struggling, let's say in the short game aspect, you know, try and improve my short game stats, or, you know, being more consistent with the driver. I think I take, you know, small goals at a time. And then in the off season, you know, make goals. So, you know, I know what I want to practice and what I want to work on, you know, compared to the year before. And you know, I think big goals for me, as in results, you know, I would love to, you know, be, you know, one of the few players to, you know, do the Korea Grand Slam. I think it's anybody's, you know, and everybody's dream to, you know, be, you know, somebody to do a Grand Slam, you know, whether that's in tennis or in golf or in any other sport, just to say that you've done the Grand Slam is, you know, very few people can say that. So that's, you know, a big goal of mine. And I think I felt that more, you know, after being so close to being able to win this KPMG event a couple years ago and the U.S. Women's Open that year too. So when you get closer, I feel like there's a bit more pressure, but it also gives you the confidence to say, hey, no, you can do it. You know, you can be in this kind of position. And just being in the first, you know, Olympics back in Rio, I think the Tokyo Olympics is definitely on my mind. You know, after the Rio, I said, man, it's another 4 years until the next one. But now it's like, oh my goodness, there's only, you know,
it's
just less
up.
Than
It'll be
2 years.
Here. Yeah.
So, yeah, it just goes by fast. But I think those are some of my big goals. And just to be able to represent your country on an international stage like that doesn't happen very often. So
I was going to say, you really seem to be highly invested in the Olympics. Or was it like that in the build up to it, or when you got there, did you realize it was a bigger deal than it was, or why is the Olympics so important to you?
You know, in 2016, you know, I wasn't really sure, oh my God, what is the Olympics going to be like? Is it going to be different to a major championship? Is it just going to be the same? Because a lot of the players you see are, you know, girls that I see on tour regularly. So, but, and even on the practice rounds, I didn't really feel like it was any different. But then on the first tee, I don't think I've ever been that nervous
really?
In my life where I barely hit the club face and it's off a tee with a driver. So it did not go as straight as I had envisioned. But you know, just to see, you know, the flag with you and just to be able to represent not only yourself and your team, but your country and everybody there is definitely a cool feeling. And for me, it was really cool that on the last day, almost like 50 New Zealand Olympians came and watched me play. And,
oh, wow.
You know, that doesn't happen either. So, yeah, I remember Eric Murray, who won the gold medal, he decided to come with his gold medal to watch me nice. Play. So that was really, really cool. And, you know, he said he passed security and they were like, oh my, what is this? And he's like, oh, this is my gold medal here. So, yeah, no, I enjoyed it. And it's great that I get to meet other Olympians and, you know, kind of hear their stories. And, I mean, it just shows what a diverse thing sport is in general.
Got to be careful when you're walking around with that you don't get a reflection off the medal right in your face. But it's interesting to kind of from your background to see that you kind of have an identity with two countries, right? I mean, you were born in South Korea, you moved to New Zealand, not even really being able to speak English. Do you remember? How old were you when you moved to New Zealand, and what was that like to try to transition to that new life?
I think I was like 6 or 7, okay. And the only letters in the alphabet I knew was A, B, C, D. And I knew it as ABDC, so so that was, you know, there's my English for you. But, you know, my golf coach, first golf coach in New Zealand, you know, he was obviously a Kiwi, and then I went to, you know, school with a lot of Kiwis. So I think that's how kind of English came out to me. And, you know, when you're at that age, you kind of pick it up a lot easier. But you know, I feel very proud to be, you know, have this South Korean background, and, you know, to also have grown up in New Zealand. And, you know, no matter if I play in Korea or New Zealand, I've been getting a lot of support from, you know, everybody there. So I think it's a pretty cool culture to be a part of.
What kind of an impact did Seiri Park? I mean, we all know Seiri Park had an enormous impact on Korean golf, but for you personally, did she have a big impact on you wanting to become a golfer?
Yeah, you know, my parents actually didn't play golf before I started, so, you know, I wasn't growing up into a golfing background, but
somebody's getting a phone call. Yeah, we're good. Yeah. All right.
Well, there was
there we go. That's an interesting variable. Yeah. We're in some random office here. We don't know. We didn't know the phone was going to ring. So.
Yeah, I don't think we should pick it up.
Probably.
That would have been a good, you know, yeah, a little twist improv, there. Have Lydia know. Answer. Yeah.
It was for Barbara, I think. I mean, one of us could pull Barbara off. Yeah, but, you know, I didn't grow up in a golfing background. Right. So, you know, it wasn't like, hey, you know, you must play golf kind of thing. I think it was either golf or ballet, my parents were saying. And, you know, with how unflexible I am, thank God it was not ballet. But, you know, Seiri, you know, she was really one of the first Korean on tour. And she really showed a path for, you know, not only Koreans, but a lot of players in Asia, and I think gave a lot of hope. And it's her 20th anniversary winning the U.S. Women's Open this year. Mm-hmm. And I think she impacted a lot of lives. And, you know, she gave hope to people in Korea. My mom was saying that it wasn't the best state that, you know, the whole of Korea was in. And I think she gave hope to people there of, you know, somebody to look up to and somebody to be really excited to root for. So lucky for me, I was able to play on tour her last few years on tour. And I've gotten to know her, and she's like a big sister of mine. You know, I went to last off season, I went to, you know, near her hometown, and we had dinner together. And she's such a super sweet person and amazing person to talk to and just hear her stories and what it was like for her, you know, on tour, because it's a lot different sure. to right now.
Who are some of your good friends out on tour? Who do you hang out with off the course some?
Danielle Kang, yeah. You know, she's
friends with everyone, isn't she?
she tells people that I'm not her friend, but she's I'm her sister. Okay. So I'm like, thank God. At first I was like, oh man, we're not friends.
And I was then, like, where's this going? Yeah.
But no, she's like a big sister of mine. I met her at the USAM actually for the first time, the second one that she won. So no, she's super sweet and somebody I really look up to. She's just a strong and amazing athlete, so I love her. And I love hanging out with the Korda sisters, who have been paired with a lot. So I said, yeah. I've been getting the Korda sandwich. I got Nelly, and then the week after I got Jess, and then the week after I got Nelly. So I think I'm bound to have, you know, both of them in one group. So yeah, you know, the girls are amazing, so it's endless. But I think those are a few. And I mean, Sue Oh, who I've known since, you know, we were probably half our height right now and half our age.
We played with her down in Australia, actually.
Oh,
we were
did?
Down there in November. Yeah, on super baked out day down in Australia. She was great. But
yeah.
This tour just seems like so much fun. I mean, we're kind of used to being on the PGA Tour, but just seeing how you guys all interact with each other and just the whole culture just seems like so much fun. I mean, I imagine for somebody at your age, I mean, you've been around in the public for a long time, but you're still very young, that it just helps to kind of have friends out there with you at all times.
Yeah, I mean, when we're out there playing, you know, obviously we're competitors and, you know, we're playing against each other. But at the same time, when, you know, somebody's hit a great shot, you know, we'll say, hey, great shot, or, you know, congratulations. And I think that's a great, it's for Barbara. you know, we just, I think, love each other's company. You know, that's why sometimes we go and watch movies together or go out to dinner. And, you know, I think that's great that, you know, obviously, at times...
We're just going to unplug the phone.
This is a popular person.
Yeah, seriously. Somebody must really need to be in touch with her.
I don't even get 3 calls in a year.
Sorry about that.
So you've obviously won this season on tour, so I definitely don't want to dwell too much on the struggles you've had in recent years, but I was curious as to whether or not, obviously you got off to this amazing start, and from some time in 2016 up until you won this season, that your game did regress some. Is there anything that you look back at and kind of point as a turning point in any way in your game? And on the flip side, is there anything you've done to kind of reverse that to get yourself back on track this season?
I think, you know, obviously I made some big decisions, but, you know, looking back now, I don't regret any one of them. You know, even from those decisions, I've changed decisions, you know, this year, but, you know, I feel like I was moving in the right direction. And, you know, even last year, you know, I was like, man, the season's done already, you know, by CME. And it just goes by so fast. And, you know, there's really no time for you to look back and, you know, worry about, hey, what could have happened, what I should have done. And, you know, I always say no regrets made. But, you know, I feel like golf is such a confidence thing where, you know, you see everyone out here, the talent level is all pretty similar. But, you know, if you get, you know, if you have a great week and you kind of gain that confidence, you kind of end up being on that momentum and keep playing well. And I think that's what golf is really about. And I think, you know, winning in San Francisco earlier this year, that made me have, you know, a top 10 the week after. So you just kind of, you know, end up being stuck on a good momentum rather than going down and having those ups and downs. But, you know, it's I almost felt like I put so much pressure on myself because, you know, I've been very lucky enough to, you know, do a few of those things, you know, early in my career, that, you know, the expectations were so high that, you know, even though when you come second, I mean, I came second, I think 3 times last year, and that's good, but it's like, oh, you just didn't do as good. So there were, you know, a lot of comparisons. Yeah. And but to me, you know, you really can't do anything about it. And all you can do is look forward and, you know, try and do whatever you think is going to be the best for you in the future in that moment.
Has there been anything, and I know a lot of people have made a big deal about the caddy changes and whatnot, but it seems like on the LPGA Tour, it's not necessarily a common thing to have for a ton of people to have the same caddy throughout. So is there anything that kind of has been misrepresented in the media about any of the changes you've made that you would want to clarify or anything in that regard? What's out there that's really not the most accurate?
I think, you know, they said, Lydia had like, I don't even know how many caddies I've had now, but, you know, my rookie year, I obviously hadn't been around the LPGA a lot before my rookie year, so I didn't really know what exactly I needed as a caddy, because, you know, for a lot of my events, my mom caddied for me at, like, the US Women's Am, Australian Am, and, you know, I was just used to her or somebody that I knew. So, you know, having a full-time caddy was definitely a new step for me. And I, too, was learning, and I'm still learning what I want and what I don't want. So that itself is a learning process. And, you know, the first year, I actually had a lot, you know, I asked the caddy, hey, you know, is it okay if we work on a trial basis? And I think rather than me saying, you know, hey, I fired that person after a few weeks, it was more that, you know, I learned, okay, maybe I need somebody that does this a bit more. So I think that was kind of the trial process, and it ended up being a huge deal. But I mean, it's done. It is true, I guess, that I had, whatever many caddies.
But the perspective on that is probably different than it's been reported.
I feel like, even now, I learn, at these times, I want my caddy to do this or help me with this, whether that's in practice or on the golf course. And, you get to learn more about yourself, too, during this process and the people that, you work with. I still feel like I'm young at heart.
I was going to say, you're just still young, period.
Young on the passport and young at heart. Yeah. Sometimes I don't feel young when I'm playing like 5 weeks in a row. But I feel like I'm getting to learn more about myself. And I think, learning is something that you never really stop doing. Yeah.
I was going to ask, kind of speaking of your age, you're in such a unique position where you're kind of a veteran out on tour a little bit, but yet you are still so young. I was just curious, do you find yourself, seeking out advice from older players, or, maybe more so on the flip side, are you kind of helping out, new players onto the tour? How does, where do you find yourself in that balance?
Yeah, any of the players, if you ask them a question about, technical side or just their experience, they're very open to say anything, what they think. I feel like I'm more in that position, even though, this is my fifth year on tour, but, there's, like Christy, she's been on tour longer than I've been alive. It's just pretty cool, what golf is, and that you can play for a really long time. And I'm sure players like Julie, let's say, she's met a lot of people in different generations, and she's a huge role model to people in the women's game too. So I think I'm definitely the one that is asking rather than the one that's asked. People, because I've been around a longish time, I feel like, hey, Brooke's only 20, and at that time I was 22, and I'm like, yeah, I am too. it's just, I think I've been very lucky to have come on tour at a younger age, just get to experience this. But I think that's the cool thing about golf, is that there's really, age is a number and experience is kind of a whole different thing.
I've heard in interviews you say that you are potentially interested in stop playing golf around the age of 30. Has that changed at any point, or why have you picked out that age, or why is that you don't picture yourself playing past the age of 30?
When I'm having harder weeks, I'm like, okay, 25. I don't know how I thought of 30, but I thought 30 was a good age to, stop playing competitive golf. I started playing when I was 5, and, pretty much up until that time, until now, my life has really been, circled around golf. So I thought that time would be good. And then for me, even after I retire, it doesn't mean I'm not going to work or anything. Sure. Who knows? I might be in your guys' shoes one day.
Do not start a podcast.
Don't do this.
No, we don't need any competition.
At least you have cool mics and all.
Well, we try.
I want to do things outside of that. I really want to study a little bit more, maybe along the lines of counseling, so I can, maybe help people. I think there's so many cool things I can do around golf whilst not playing golf. So I think, I don't know how I came up with that number, but I thought something around that would be good. And have a family, who knows? That's way too early to talk about family right now. But I thought that was a good number. And it's a lot of the, Onyes, the big sisters on tour, they're like, oh, you know what? You probably get up to that age and go, oh man, I'm already 30. I still want to play. So
it's going
to
happen fast.
Yeah. I was just say, as someone on the other side of 30, when I was 20 or, whatever, 30 seems so far away, but man, it comes quick.
Yeah, that's what they said. They're like, okay, they said their goal was to play until they're 30, and then they're like, oh, I'm 31 now. It just hits you really quick. So I think I would never retire before knowing exactly what I want to do afterwards. I think that's the big key for me. And there's no point in me saying drop the clubs and go, okay, so what do I do now? I want to be prepared for that moment.
Makes sense. So, all right. Well, Lydia, thank you so much for your time. Best of luck this week. I hope the weather is a little different than what we got today. We'll let Barb get her office back.
Yeah,
exactly.
Sorry,
yeah.
Barb, if you're listening, we're sorry.
We're sorry for unplugging your phone.
We hope it wasn't
broke
an
your
urgent.
Phone. Sorry. Yeah.
But yeah, thank you so much for joining us in a major week. I know it's not the easiest thing to do. So, best of luck this week.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks, Lydia.
All right. Thank you to Lydia for the time. That was really fun. And as mentioned in the beginning, we have another interview here with Karen Stupples from the Golf Channel. Please stick around for this one. I promise you'll enjoy it. Some awesome insight from her on her career, her story, which is her background is incredible. I promise that story is going to shock you a bit, as well as some things she's learned in her announcing career on the Golf Channel. So here is Karen Stupples. All right, welcoming in, I don't know if I technically would call you a pro-am partner from yesterday, considering you are a professional golfer. I mean, we tied for second in the net score yesterday. This is Karen Stupples we're talking with. Do we get disqualified because you're not an am? We were cheating.
She was a ringer, yeah. For sure.
I was, and I will confess to that. That being said, I really haven't played much golf, and probably I play less golf than anybody of those amateurs that were playing in the field, so... Technically, I think I'm good.
It didn't seem that way, but you had some shots that were a little, the rust was there, but then you would show that your 3-wood into the par 3. Tell us that story. Your closest to pin and who you beat. Yeah.
Well, all of a sudden we're playing and Golf Central show up on the scene to film Michelle Wee, who was our partner, and she was tremendous all day long. So all of a sudden, I feel like a little bit of pressure because these are the people that I work with now. I'm like, okay, I've got to show them that I can actually still play every once in a while. So Michelle Wee stands there, just kind of eases a 7-wood in. I'm like, I'm going to have to muscle a 3-wood because that's how things are these days for me. So I whacked a 3-wood up there, and sure enough, I hit it to 3 feet, 7 inches. But it was even better because I beat Jerry Foltz, who was in the group in front of us, who thought that he had hit a career 4-iron to, I think he said, 6 feet. And then after that, my boss, Molly Solomon, who's in charge of Golf Channel, she hit one to about 5 feet. So I beat her too. So I'm not sure if I'm in their good books or not, but I don't care. I'm like one up.
You're going to be rubbing that in their faces a little
Absolutely.
Bit.
Absolutely.
I will say too, I had the pleasure of walking with you guys and seeing everything. You know, Karen started out playing from the pro tees, the back tees. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, I think you guys turned in maybe 4-under as a team, and that competitive, you know, light switch kind of came on the back nine. And so she moved forward as she was allowed to do technically under the rules. And I think she was certainly gunning for the pro-am title.
Yeah, well,
but
I mean,
on that hole with the closest to pin, she's like, I better play this from the back.
She did play it back.
Because I knew. I'm like, okay, this is closest to the pin. I've got to go back. Yeah. But but even then, moving up, it really didn't help. Because the further I moved up, the more wayward I got off the tee. So I'm like, okay, it's not helping anybody.
So I think for most people listening by this point, they're recognizing your voice, at least, even if they maybe not were familiar with what you do. So tell us, we'll get into your background a bit, but tell us what people would know you from these days.
Primarily, I cover LPGA tournaments for Golf Channel. I'm either in the booth when Judy Rankin doesn't want to work, and then otherwise I'm on the ground as Jerry Foltz's backup. And I have a great time doing it. Still get to travel around and talk about golf, and I love solving problems when it comes to golf. I love looking at people's swings. I love figuring out what makes them tick, why they were successful or why things didn't work out quite so well that week for them. It's just a big puzzle for me, and that's what I find incredibly fun about it.
You are yourself a major champion. You won the Open Championship in 2004, okay, at Sunningdale. So you now are on this side of the ropes. We're here at the KPMG Women's PGA Championship, obviously. You are now covering this as a major. What kind of perspective do you have now that you're removed from the game watching these competitors play a major that maybe you wish you had when you were playing majors in your day?
Well, this is a tremendous one, and what KPMG and the PGA of America have done with this is they've formed a tournament that really was on life support as the LPGA Championship. And I remember playing my first LPGA Championship at DuPont Country Club. It then moved to Bully Rock. And then after that, it really was on life support. It went to Locust Hill. Wegmans took it over. It went from a regular tournament at Locust Hill to a major. And it was really struggling. And I think that what this has done is made a really sort of a, I would say almost the best tournament in women's golf. And I think it's only 4 years in and it's already starting to feel that way. All the players talk about how well things are run, how extremely good, you know, their services are, you know, the food in the clubhouse, the condition of the course, everything is really well organized. They love the fact that KPMG is supporting women in all manner of ways. What KPMG are doing for Stacey Lewis is tremendous in terms of keeping her sponsorship going while she's pregnant. And because most people, most companies prorate that. So if you're supposed to play in your contract 20 events, if you can only play 10, they'll take half your money away. So, you know, for them to support Stacey through that is pretty huge. And just in general, I think players love being here. And now, as I look on it, yes, I'd love to be playing in this event. It would be tremendous to be shown this kind of respect for your game. Do I miss playing? No, I don't miss it at all. I watch the grind. I see them every single step of the way. You know, they're working hard, they're training, the practice hours. I mean, just looking at it now, right now, I don't have to worry about slogging my way around that golf course because it's a bit of a slog out there. It's beautiful, but it's tough and it's wet and it's long and the greens are treacherous and I just get to talk about them now. So it's a beautiful thing.
There's not much left of the golf course after I dug up most of it yesterday with my divots. But
well, I just wish I'd saved them all and taken them home to do my yard with them.
Well, it's interesting you say that about KPMG and kind of, you know, and being here. We have much more experience being at PGA Tour events than we do LPGA events. But the infrastructure and the support around the event, I mean, we were blown away at the Skills Challenge on Monday. I mean, all the athletes they brought in for that, the fact that they're doing it for the kids, and they rented out Soldier Field for a day for this. I mean, those kind of things don't happen on the LPGA Tour for the most part.
No.
So, I mean, it's the purse this week is fantastic as well, so it is kind of cool to see how excited the players are. For all the things you mentioned mean a lot to players, and like the infrastructure around the tournament and the hospitality and the food and the location and the convenience, really.
Things that I think PGA Tour pros can take for granted, like getting a courtesy car every week. That doesn't happen on the LPGA Tour, but they know when they come here, they're going to get a courtesy car.
Yeah.
So it's just nice to know that you're going to be taken care of and looked after.
Definitely. So we kind of jumped into, you know, you being a major champion and what you do now, but I want to hear kind of a bit of your background and how you got into professional golf. And there's a pretty excellent story that you told yesterday about how you ended up getting out there and playing professional full time. So
it was crazy. Growing up as a little girl on the southeast coast of England, I had no idea what professional golf was all about. I just knew that I loved to play golf. And the only professional tournaments I'd ever seen for women was the Women's British Open. That was the only thing that I knew was any that was out there for me to play in.
Can we get this on record? We have a Brit that called it the British Open.
Yeah, I was going to correct you. It's actually
for anybody
just
the technical
open
term, though, Women's British Open, it's okay.
Oh, that's true. Okay,
yeah,
you're
the
right.
Women's one is fine.
You're right.
If,
okay.
If I'm talking about Open.
We get a lot of grief from British listeners that we're actually steering into it now, and we're calling it the UK British Open. But they give us grief for calling it the British Open. But sorry to interrupt, but continue.
No. And so so I would watch that, but not really realizing what was out there. But my golf progressed really, really quite quickly. I became very good early, played for England, and that essentially got me a scholarship to play in America. So I came out here to college, went through the college system.
Where did you go?
My freshman year I went to Arkansas State in Jonesboro. But one of the provisions that I'd said to the coach was, I just don't want any snow. Well, it snowed. So I'm like, okay, time to move on. So luckily they were great. They released me and I transferred, went to Florida State. So I became a Seminole, had a good time there.
Had you ever been to the States before coming over for college?
Never been, never traveled. And my parents just put me on a plane at Heathrow and said, bye.
Good luck.
And it was a crazy thing. I came with my suitcase and my golf clubs, and that's all I had in the whole world. And I got dropped off at my dorm. There was nothing in my dorm. The bed had no sheets, I had no towels, I had no nothing. And I'm like, oh, I didn't think of this.
You didn't have a car probably?
Didn't have a car, I had nothing. And luckily one of the other girls who was playing on the golf team was going to join me. She came the next morning and she said, you don't have anything. Because I just slept on a bare mattress that night.
Oh.
And she said, you really have nothing, do you? I said, no, this is all I have. She said, we need to get you to Walmart. So off we went. We went to Walmart and
that's
I
a great
up.
First American experience
yeah,
to
Walmart.
Go to Walmart. Yeah, exactly.
I'm like, this is the greatest store
especially
ever.
Especially in Arkansas too.
Well, you know, that's home of.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's the greatest store ever though to me that morning because I finally had bed stuff and a towel.
Yeah. And so then from college, did you go back? You went back to the UK after that?
I always knew that by the time I got to college, it opened my eyes to LPGA. I'm like, okay, this is where I want to be. This is what I want to do. But I didn't know how to get here. My family really don't have a lot of money. My mum was pressing blouses in a factory, and my dad was directing traffic around the port of Dover. So my family doesn't have very much. And the thought of, you know, being able to rely on them just wasn't there. Whatever I was going to do, I was going to have to do for myself. So I made the Curtis Cup team, played on that, continued with my amateur career, but also at the same time, I worked pretty much full time at a golf course called Etching Hill, doing bar work and waitressing and whatever I could do to make ends meet and try and find time to practice a bit of golf along the way. And as it turned out, one of my regular customers was coming in, and eventually he asked me, his name was Keith Rawlings, and he said to me, "Why haven't you turned pro yet? I keep seeing your name in the paper. You keep winning these amateur events. What's going on?" I said, "Well, I'm working hard. I'm just trying to save the money to try." So I gave him a little rundown of the story of, you know, needing money to enter Q school and to travel to America to do all of this. He said, "Oh," he said, "that's interesting." So I cleaned the trays off and bring some dessert out. And he said, "My wife and I have been talking. We'd like to give you the money to try." And I'm like, "What?"
Wait, what?
And she said, no, we really mean it. She said, his wife, Sue, she said, "We've been very lucky all our lives. People have treated us well, and we feel like you really deserve a chance. You work hard, and we want to see you at least have a go at it." I was completely blown away. She said, come to our office in the morning with a budget, and we'll go over it and see what we can do. So that night, like after finishing at midnight, I'm like scribbling my budget down, trying to get, I'm like, okay, cross the I's, dot the T's, okay, don't look like an idiot, try and make this look like professional. I go into to their office the next morning, and he barely even looked at it and said, "That's fine." He said, "I'll give you it for 3 years because I don't want you to feel like you have any pressure the first time to make it." So off I went with his financial help, and I got my card the first time, and I've never looked back since. And that was it. Without his help, I could still be waiting tables, waiting to turn pro at Etching Hill, because at £3 an hour, it doesn't get you very far.
It's amazing. Like, you told that incredible story yesterday, and yeah. I just was like, all right, we have to have her on the podcast immediately. I mean, that's the butterfly effect in life. I mean, that's, you're no better example of anything than that. I mean, you made a full career of, you just retired, what, in 2014?
Yeah, 14.
So you had a long career. I mean, especially in women's golf.
Yep.
I mean, careers don't seem to last as long as they do in men's golf. But, and I was curious, I mean, you know, we talk to a lot of girls out here, and we talked to, you know, we're going to talk to Brittany Lincecum today, who's 32, who is well past the median age, I think, out here on tour. For those listening at home, why does the median age or the age in the, on the LPGA Tour trend so young compared to men's golf? Do you have any insight on that?
Well, I really think a lot of it is to do from a young age that the women mature physically a lot earlier than the guys, and almost to a certain extent mentally as well. And you don't need a huge amount of power to be successful on the LPGA Tour. If you look at the recent world number ones, you look at Lydia Ko, Imbi Park, who's currently the world number one, they're not the longest players in the world. They're very average off the tee. So you don't need to develop physically to get the power to play golf well enough to be competitive on tour. So what you're seeing is that they're very well coached, they come to this early, and here they are, they're ready to play golf. They're not scared, you know, the youngsters aren't scared. And in many ways, I can see the advantages of it, because at some point, as a woman, you have to make a decision. Do I want to have a family? Am I going to try and play when I have a family? Or can I get all my golf in and then just do a Lorena Ochoa, retire and have a family? So all of these things you kind of think of, but you don't think of, but that's definitely a part in sort of nature's way of progressing. And one of my biggest beefs at the moment is the fact that the senior women's open is coming up. It's the first year they've had it. They're starting at 50. In my mind, 50 is too old.
Yeah.
And even the Legends Tour is at 45 starting is too old. I think all of senior women's golf should literally start at 40, because if you look at comparing like-to-like with the PGA Tour, you've probably got about four players on the PGA Tour that are competitive on the PGA Tour at 50. And it's very much the same on the LPGA Tour. You've probably got about four players over the age of 40 that are competitive. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, is where it needs to go, because by the time you have players, women players reaching 50, they've already quit playing for about 15 years. And it's so hard to get going, or if not 15 years, at least 10 years. And it's so hard to get back into it. So that's really my thing. But I think that it's just maturing so young and it being available and having role models that have already done it, that they can see, oh, well, if Lydia Ko can do it, then why can't I?
So you told me yesterday, I hope you don't mind me kind of repeating this, but you said you're just coming out of your phase where you really hated golf.
Yeah.
You know, kind of the natural, you know, you'd retired and
yeah.
been away from the game and, you know, just playing a little bit frustrating. So I'm just curious, do you have any plans? Is that something that, do you ever see yourself returning to play competitively?
I think that I would like to play every once in a while, because not from a desire to compete per se, but a desire to remind myself of the daily grind and how hard it is for the players that I talk about now. I think that they deserve that from me, because it's very easy for me to sit there in the 18th tower or on the course and pass judgment and comment on their performance. And that's, you know, that's what I'm paid to do. I'm there to be, and I try and be as fair as I possibly can and as honest, and I try and critique them as if I would do myself. And so it's only fair that I should remind myself of exactly what it takes to do what they do day in, day out. Because when you don't do it, you it's very easy to forget how hard it actually is playing professional golf and all the sacrifices that you make along the way to get to that point. So I think it's more from a learning perspective. I did play a tournament in 16. I played at ShopRite in Atlantic City and didn't make the cut, hit some really good shots, hit some very bad shots. But to me, what I learned from that experience was how fine a line playing the difference between a 65 and a 72 is. Mm-hmm. You can be 3 feet off from 160 yards out, and you miss that little ridge in the green, and it comes trickling all the way back down, and you end up off the front edge of the green. Then from the front edge of the green, you've got to have a chip up. If you miss your pitching landing area by 6 inches, you're 20 feet past the hole, and that's how bogeys happen. You know, from 165 yards out, 3 feet of difference. It's not very much. That's how precise you have to be to have a good score. And so that's really what I became very aware of that.
That's what's keeping us from 65.
That's all it is.
It's just a matter of feet.
It's got to jot that down. We're 3 feet away from 65.
At Meadow Hill Championship in San Francisco, their title were Inches Make All the Difference.
Yeah, I like that.
We had a giggle about it at the time, but you know.
I was just going to quickly follow up. Was it difficult at all in your new role as a commentator? Did it take some getting used to be a little bit critical of players, or were you at all apprehensive kind of stepping into that role?
I think yes. There's no doubt about it, and it takes a while for you to find your voice, mm-hmm. to really understand that what you're saying has value, or that is actually, it's not just correct to your own personal game, but it's correct to everybody's game, because ultimately golf is golf. It doesn't matter whether you're Tiger Woods, whether you're Lydia Ko, you're still trying to get the ball in the hole in as few shots as possible. So when I look at that, I'm like, you know, as a player, if I can go home at night and say, if somebody had said that about me, how would I have reacted, and was it a fair comment to make? And if I can go home and say it was a fair comment, then that's totally fine. If I can leave any kind of emotional, you know, if it's a player that I might not be that friendly with, I might not like that much, or if it's somebody that I really like, you know, you try and leave all that, you put all that to one side and just try and look at it completely objectively. It's like, okay, what's just happened? And if I can go home at night and say that to myself, then I can give myself a little pat on the back and feel like, okay, that was fine. And I've had a few confrontations. I've had a confrontation with a coach and one with a player about something that I've said. And I'm probably going to get ready to have another one later this week. So so I'm bracing myself for it. But there are times when there are just things that I see. And it comes from a perspective of wanting to help as much as anything. It's mm-hmm. like I see talented players. I'm like, why are things not going the way they should be going?
And that's what you're paid to do, right, is to give your opinion on that, your perspective on it. You have all this experience in the game. You know, if it's me or Randy here doing that analysis, that doesn't mean nearly as much. But I imagine that, that the fine line between taking what you observe and determining kind of what you think on it, and also the difference between that and projecting onto it, be like, oh, it must be a mental thing versus, you know, kind of from my perspective, I think she might be battling with this. I think that is kind of got to be a tough line to balance, I imagine.
It is. And it's, as I said, it's hard because you know that every week you're going to see the same players and you're going to be covering the same people. And again, I don't want to hurt their golf games, and I don't want to cause conflict with them or their coaches or anybody else, because I know as a player how important it is to have one universal voice in your head when you're standing over a golf shot. You don't need conflicting ideas. That's horrible. And I will always try and approach a coach for their input and their things first before I make any comments on what they're actually doing, because I think that's important to get that one voice.
You owe that to them at least.
Yeah, exactly. There are times when coaches don't want to help you too, and that I find that immensely frustrating, because ultimately I'm trying to help their players. You know, I also want to sound informative and knowledgeable on TV, but I'm also trying to help their players by not asking them directly about it, and then have that in their minds.
Have you ever had any slip-ups on the air or any curse words? Or how do you avoid saying curse words on the air?
Well, I actually was on really good behavior yesterday on the golf course too. and I had to engage the same policy that I take when when I'm going on air. Because typically if I'm just playing golf or if I'm living normal life, my language can be pretty ripe. I can throw F-bombs as good as I can throw golf clubs. You know, it's the two go hand in hand. And typically if a golf club is thrown, so is an F-bomb and everything else. So I figure that if I get all my Fs out before I go on air, I do good. So if you're ever walking past the porta toilet at an LPGA event and you hear this F, 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 D, F, 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 that's me in there getting them all out.
That would make me more likely to say it, I think. I don't know how you do that.
I always had a theory with patience too. My theory on patience is that every day you wake up with a certain allotment of patience. And I used to call them tokens. You know, it's, okay, I've got all these patience tokens. And how I choose to use them is what I do throughout the course of the day. When I play golf, they could go on the first hole. Patience tokens gone, out the window, done. I've spent them all on the first hole. But it made me more aware. It's like, okay, I need to be conscious of how I'm spending my patience tokens throughout the course of a round of golf, and it enabled me to kind of stretch things out a bit. When I became a mother and you have a two-year-old, those patience tokens went really quickly.
What about when you miss short putts and there's potentially water hazards nearby?
Oh yeah,
are there ever any incidents with that?
Well, if you go to there's a guy on Twitter called Ghost of Hogan, and if you go on his Twitter site, you'll be able to see him swimming around in a pond at Columbia Edgewater Country Club. It's where they played a Portland Classic, Columbia Edgewater Country Club. And played golf with Jerry Foltz, myself, Paul, the assistant there, Ghost of Hogan, and the head pro, Brian. And we had this match, and it was Brian and I against Paul and Jerry. So it's a very tight match, and we get through to the eighth hole on the tournament course, which is the 17th hole that the members play. And it was our 17th hole of the night, and it was dark. And I've hit a great shot in there, par three, water hazard on the right. And I am so, so fed up because I've missed putts all day long. And this is a brand new putter. Shh, don't tell anybody. and I just couldn't help myself. Jerry had made his putt. I missed my putt. It was literally 3 feet. And I was so mad because I'd hit such a good shot, and I've been missing them all day. Like, I'm like, I did the classic golf pro move, throw the ball into the water. I winged the ball into the water, and then after that I'm like, that's not enough, there has to be more. I'm like, what's more than that? Okay, putter's gone too. So I literally double-handed it, winged it in the water, made a big splash, and there was a ton of f-bombs and any other bad curse word that you could possibly imagine came out of my mouth. Meanwhile, they're all rolling around on the floor dying laughing at me. But, Ghost, Paul, went swimming for that putter. Couldn't find it, but I think it's like Excalibur. I think it's one of those things that, you know, the Lady of Columbia Edgewater Lake will kind of raise it out of the water and reveal itself to some worthy player that will actually make putts with it, because it didn't work for me. So that was that.
Do you have a most embarrassing moment either announcing or walking a golf course?
Yeah, I do. Of course I do. I have embarrassing moments all the time. Biggest one recently was at the President's Cup, and I was following Charlie Hoffman and Jason Day in the singles match, and it was a fairly quiet day for me on the golf course, which as a on-course commentator, it can be that way. Sometimes you might call three shots over the course of a four-hour show. So I was out there just kind of rolling around, not really... I was paying attention, but knowing that they weren't going to come to me, so I was kind of just enjoying my little walk a bit, and I saw Charlie hit a ball, and it looked like it was going into the left bunker, so I'm like, okay, I'll just, you know, wander up, and you have a little hustle on, but not too much, and so I'm walking, and I know Charlie is just literally 10 steps right behind me, so I'm like, okay, I've got to really kind of get out the way here, because he's catching me pretty quick, so I'm on go slow, and as I'm walking up, I felt this ball on my foot, and I've made contact with his golf ball. I'm like, shit. I was like, okay, let the ground swallow me up, because I turned around and Charlie said, oh, you just kicked my ball. I said, yeah, luckily I don't have a strong leg, it only went a yard. But it was so bad. I was so embarrassed, but he was great about it. It was no big deal, and I followed him a couple of other times since, and he's been totally cool. But they just replaced it where it was, and it's no big deal.
So you should have told him you had a terrible lie. I actually did you a favor. That helped a little bit. So there's actually a cool story from your British Open win. You were telling me about, and just about going into the season, you didn't know much about Sunningdale. You weren't sure about your matchup there. So you had someone there in your ear that was telling you something different.
It's true. At the start of the year, I used to sit down with my golf coach, Chip Kelkey, who was at the Marriott Golf Academy there in Orlando. And he's since moved on, but he was a tremendous coach. And we would sit down, start of the season, and work through the schedule to work out what tournaments I would play, where I would miss, how to maximize my performance, basically. So we were going through it, and he said to me, how do you feel about Sunningdale? You know, which was where they played the British Open. And I'm like, well, I'm not really sure. It's neither, you know, I played it many times growing up. I'm like, yeah, it's neither inland, it's not really links, it's kind of a bit in between. I'm just a bit ho-hum about it. And he said to me, he said, well, for some reason, he said, I think you're going to have a great week there. I'm like, wow. And sure enough, came off with the win. I mean, I don't even know how or why he even thought that, but he just had a feeling for it.
And you had an albatross?
Started eagle, albatross in the final round. 5 under par through the first two holes.
It was the first two holes?
First two holes of the final round.
So that was going to be my question. What? Standing on the third tee, what was going through your mind?
Well, I literally, you know, my caddy, who was my ex-husband at the time, we still got on great. That's no big deal.
But he was your ex-husband as he was caddying?
Yeah, he was my husband at the time. He's now my ex.
Gotcha,
But he said to me, let's go shoot 59. I'm like, all right. Like, but I was in just one of those, in my own little world. I mean, they talk about the zone. I mean, I literally was in my own little world, in my bubble. Nothing else was going on around me, but I really felt like I was going to make everything. So I stood on the next tee, hit a great shot, and then I hit a 52-degree wedge on the next hole that, for all intents and purposes, I thought I was going to hole. It was right on line. It just landed just a bit short of the hole and then spun back to about 20 feet. But it looked like I'd made another one. I'm like, oh, made another one.
Here we go.
And it was just one of those days where I kind of fell a bit flat in the middle, but just did, you know, kept well enough ahead of Rachel Hetherington, who was chasing me at the time. And then I stood on the 15th tee, and all of a sudden I had a weight, and I realized I could win the British Open. Up until that point, it wasn't even in my mind about winning it. I'm like, oh my God, I could win this. This is it. And I had a one-shot lead at that point. All of a sudden, I got really nervous.
I was going to say that.
I'm like, that's when the nerves kicked in. Prince Andrew shows up on the tee. The owner of the sponsor shows up on the tee. The whole of the gallery is now following my group. I'm like, oh, this is really happening. And for some reason, like with all things that happen with golf, you know, good things, you know, you can tell if it's meant to be for a player. And it was meant to be for me that week, because that hole, the 15th, I managed to scrape a 7-wood around the green on a par 3. But I made a putt from about 30 feet that lipped in on the low side. Putts never lip in on the low side, but that one did. So then I finished birdie, 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 par, and 1 by 5. And that was it.
Would you say you married the speed and the line of that putt?
The speed were perfectly married.
So give us that. You have a you have kind of a list of cliches of some kind of things you don't want to say on the air. What are some of those?
I hate the ball rolling end over end because the ball's round. How can it roll? It doesn't have an end. It just rolls. So that's a little pet peeve.
Now that you pointed some of these out yesterday, I heard like one of them on an interview, and I'm like, oh, now I'm going to hear it everywhere.
These are going to be like, once you hear them, you can't unhear them.
The glass breaking moment.
Exactly. And I'm not a big fan of the fairway metal either.
No.
Okay. It's a wood. It's a wood.
It's better than less than driver. She's going with less than driver here. Okay, that doesn't help us.
that's true. Well, and the only reason why you'd say that is because you're not right by the tee and you can't see if it's actually a hybrid or a 3-wood or a 5-wood and the caddy hasn't given you a signal.
Sure.
And you're like, I don't know what it is. It's something, I'm going to have a guess. I've got nothing good to add apart from that it's not a driver. And then what's the other one? The marrying the speed and the line. It's like, well, that's fairly obvious. You know, but and again, it's sometimes that's the only thing that pops into your head because it's so cliche that everybody wants to say it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just the only thing that is in there. And you know that something's got to come out, so that's what you reach for. Exactly.
Left hand, right hand side.
Oh, that's, I don't get that either. Why people say down the right hand side or down the left hand side when you can just say it's down the right or it's down the left because everybody knows what it is.
That was the glass breaking moment for me, that one.
You're of course.
That's right.
Just simple things.
I want to ask you, you know, the kind of the record breaking start there in the final round of the Women's British Open. Mm-hmm. Got to be a record that
I would imagine so.
You know, it's going to be tough to beat that one. But you also, I'm curious if the record still stands. So you set the scoring record on the LPGA Tour with a cumulative 258.
Yep.
Do you know, does that still stand?
Yeah, it still stands.
Okay.
I think it's been done again, but it still stands.
All right.
Yeah.
How many under was that?
Well, it was a par 70, so I shot 63, 66, 66, 63.
You remember that off the top of your head that?
Yeah. And the only reason I say that is because I can't add up. So that's what I shot.
There you go.
And I'm not going to even try and add that up.
What's it like being in the zone? You know, it's one thing to do it over the course of a round, but to kind of string four straight together.
It's very difficult. Which is why you'll see players have a really great round and then have a not so great round. That's one of the reasons I think that happens is that you'll have it off and on throughout the course of the tournament. Some rounds you'll have it the whole time. And the goal is to get it as often as you possibly can, but it's so difficult and so rare to find. People ask me about that final round, and there's a bit of it in the middle that I really can't remember anything about it because I hadn't. There was no film of it. There was no TV coverage from some of those shots. And if I hadn't seen it, I can't really remember. I couldn't remember it because I was so in my own little world and so in just playing one shot at a time and doing that's another cliche thing.
One shot at a time. But players say that a lot too. It's part of a thought process.
Yeah. So it's if I hadn't seen it, I would never know what it was. That's zone. But the process. We talked about the process leads to the zone.
Right.
So the better you are with the process, the more likelihood you are of finding that. It's still elusive, and even for the best players in the world, they rarely find it.
Yeah, I was gonna say if you knew how to yourself into the zone, you know, you could bottle that up and make a lot of money. But
I think it's a combination of confidence as well as the process and just enjoying the fact that the ball is doing exactly what you want it to do.
Mm-hmm. It's cyclical, too. I mean, it's like your good play is going to breed the confidence, which is going to breed more good play, but you can't be confident if you're not playing well. So
exactly.
And I don't know what comes first, and that's the madness that you probably were talking about when it comes to the grind of this game and the struggle that's come with it. I mean, Lydia Ko was number one in the world at the age of 19, and then 2 years later, it was like, what seems to be going on here? It can happen to literally anyone. So.
It can, and I think Lydia's change has been because she wants to improve. She wants to get better. She knows that if she sits still, there's going to be another talented player chasing her down and taking over that spot. And you can never sit still with golf. You've always got to keep trying to keep moving forward. And people always argue, well, if it's not broke, don't fix it. Well, that's easier said than done when you know that there's potentially more within you to get out. And I think that's what we saw with Lydia. But the trouble with her was that she did it all in one time. She did the clubs, that she did the caddy, she did the coach, she did everything all in one fell swoop. And then she lost a lot of weight as well on top of it. And all of those things take time to adjust to.
We'll get you out of here on this. We hate making predictions, especially ahead of majors. Ooh. And even on the LPGA Tour, we would be even worse at it. Yep. Do you have I'm sure you get this question a lot, but do you have a pick coming into this week? And
oh, you know, it's funny, you know, picking for this week, having played the course now, we've had a lot of rain here and it's playing long. But you've got to be accurate too. You've got to, I think having a good caddy is huge this week. I think the person who has a great caddy is going to work out well, because you've got to know how far the carriers are over the bunker. You've got to know how far it then is to run through to the next one. The greens are awkward angles from the fairway, that they diagonally slope towards the back of the green in terms of, you got to carry, you know, to carry the middle of the green is more than to carry the front and then the back. You've got to know all those numbers.
There's,
you've got
different
to be
quadrants all
distance
over them,
control
yeah.
is of a premium, and you have to look at people who have form coming in, because you can't find form at a major. You've got to have some kind of form coming in. And, you know, it's hard to escape your Lexi Thompson, who played well last week in Arkansas, or Aria Jutanagarn, also played well in Arkansas, you know, as the winner of the US Open as well, plays well on really wet golf courses. US Open was soggy. Kingsmill, the other place that she won, also really soggy. And I think for her, she's a bit of an iffy driver of the golf ball. You rarely ever see her with a driver in the hand. And I think when the golf course is wet, it almost feels like it's that much wider for her. Like she, because the fairways don't run out, I think she feels like she can open up a bit more and have more freedom. So I think that's why you see her do well on those courses. That those two would probably be my favourites, but I wouldn't rule out a Jessica Korda or a Nelly Korda or someone like that, because their ball striking is just absolutely spot on. And I watched Nelly Korda play a couple of weeks ago at Meyer, and I don't think I've ever been more impressed with somebody's driving ever.
Really?
So that's kind of those would be my picks. I mean, you can never rule out an MB Park,
sure,
but I think this is a little too long for her of a golf course, especially being so wet.
You heard it here. Bomber's paradise here. So, yep. All right, Karen, thank you so much for your time and for being such an awesome pro-am partner. And,
I had a great team.
It was a really fun day.
And we didn't lay up once.
We
so
did
there
not.
You go.
We did not. But sometimes to our detriment. But
never.
Best of luck this week. Thanks so much for joining us. And we'll be hearing you on the air.
Sweet. Thank you. Look forward to it.
Thank you.
Be the right club. Be the right club today. Yeah.
Johnny, that's better than most.
How about him?
That is better than most. Better than most!